This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Do you consider yourself a literary heavyweight? You know, a person who believes that the key components of great literature are about bearing the human soul, weaving it with beautiful words, threading it with the great philosophies of all time. Well, get ready to have your world turned pretty much upside down. And welcome to episode 8 of New Voices, where I interview Kat Davey. She would like to elevate modern satirical women's fiction to a higher tier of the fiction realm. When I first heard Kat Davey read out her work, I could not stop smiling, and I could not abstain from thinking, how the hell is she doing this? She's entertaining me, stimulating me intellectually, prodding my social conscience. How can someone with such a light, deft touch hit such heavy body blows in terms of literary impact? I think Kat has created her own genre. It's uplifting, uplit literature. It's not chick lit, strictly speaking, definitely upmarket. Heavily spiced with satire and wit, all set in a modern frame and a modern reference. Enter stage left her critiquer, Arik Sanayan, an engineer, a climate change expert, who is still wiping the sweat from his brow from fighting the good fight. But nothing, he says, compares with the deep challenge involved in writing his first novel. A mystery thriller set in the world of high art, philosophy, music. What does he think of Kat's work? Well, Arik is the type of chap who has never heard of uplit. I think he thought I was saying something rude. But he was mesmerized by Kat's process. So get ready to be seduced. Keep your wits about you. Don't be fooled by those girlish tones in her interview. In brisk rapidity, she deals out many tricks of her trade that only a fashion-savvy business writer who has turned her hand to romance writing can achieve. And since both of them are interested in mystery novels and nail-biting chapters, bite your nails thinking about this. What does an obituary column, an endless stream of dead people, a distaste for sex scenes, soul-searching angst in writing, and cellulite have in common? Welcome, Kat, to the non-studios of 2RPH here in Des Moines.
Thank you.
You know that I've really loved your work. When you started writing, was this the way that you intended?
No.
Because, like, your voice finds you, you don't find your
Absolutely.
Voice.
Yeah. I was trying to write a sort of mystery thriller story. Yeah. My favourite books are books that are satire, you know, clever, and I think that's why when I started to write, and I don't want to say funny, laugh on the floor, funny, but, you know, I liked that kind of satirical take on things.
Yeah.
And some happy endings.
Very soon people will get hear you and see what I'm talking about, because it is, you know, such a lovely crochet, you know,
That's a beautiful of writing. Term for my writing.
You know, the way that you you pick all those pieces together and make it, you know, something that's just uniquely you.
I get annoyed that women's writing, when it involves a romance, is always tossed into the bin of romantic comedy and women's fiction, and it's not really given any respect.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that you can write a genre that's usually associated with being, you know, not very clever and not very smart, but do it in a way, you know, elevates it. Like, I often think lots of plots of really literary things really don't go anywhere, but they're beautifully written.
But yours is witty, clever, insightful, and also has these layers of social analysis. So I've always likened it to Jane Austen.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention Jane Austen, because she gets a mention in what I'm going to read today.
Oh, excellent.
It was probably one of the first books I read that I absolutely love, Pride and Prejudice. You know, you can't not be changed by that writer.
And what is it that makes that work? Because basically it's a cliff-hanging romance and biting your nails.
I love some nail biting and some happy endings and some interesting people that are maybe not serious.
You do use as a platform like the magazine industry and the newspaper industry.
Yeah.
And this is your background. So
I spent some time in Singapore and I actually really did not like it. Even though I thought I would love it. I was really frustrated. I remember once my editor really went mad at me when I was having to do some photo shoot with peacocks and society people. And I just went, oh my God, I so don't want to do that. And she said, you don't have a choice. Just get there and start complaining. And I was like, well, okay. I just felt like, you know, it's just really shallow and it's not real. And even though I'd always wanted to do that and it was a top job in that country at the time.
Yeah. Did your writing career start there?
Well, I did communications at uni but was never confident enough to be a writer. So I ended up, I worked in broking and banking, business writing. It's very uncreative. Anytime I was creative, it didn't really get me anywhere. My mother passed away and I was left with some money that meant I didn't have to work that hard. I think the biggest turning point was coming to Writers Group, because at Writers Group, it was a question of not if you can write, you just write.
Yeah. And was the Writers Group that we met, was that the first Writers Group you've been to?
Yes.
No way. I didn't know that.
It was very nerve-wracking. And I'd written about, I don't know, 10,000 words at that point. So I didn't really know if I could write. I hadn't found my voice. I found it very stressful writing. Reading out made me think, oh, okay, I can write.
A whole range of people that I've seen react to your work from a really wide demographic, and they all find it funny. But in that edgy way, it's cerebral funny.
Right. I knew I could write in a kind of non-fiction journalism way, and that came very easily for me. What I didn't realise is that with a little tweak, it comes very easily in a creative way as well.
What was that tweak?
Well, it was doing a lot of intellectualizing to begin with, and then I just flipped it to, I'm just going to, what's the expression? Free write. Mm. And that changed everything. So I stopped worrying about whether it was good or just to get the flow going. I would sit down and just almost channel through about my writing from my, I don't know, higher self, the universe, or whatever you want to call it. And once I kind of freed myself, sort of unleashed the beast, I stopped worrying about if what I said was too mean or to un-PC, or just realised my voice is my voice. And
everyone in your stories is real, at the same time, a little bit of a parody of themselves.
Absolutely. Gee, I wish you could write my one page.
I can't write my own one page. I think it's the worst thing. It's like self-surgery.
So awesome. Yes, it is. I think every character is pushed to be a slight caricature of that character, but not enough that you... Because I find some absurdist humour is quite alienating and you think, oh, this is just so try hard.
Yeah.
So I tried to keep it in that subtle balance.
It seems so effortless, and it's the effortlessness that makes it like an easy road to travel with you.
That's where the journalism comes in, because writing it simply, quickly, having something that gets to the point. When you're a journalist, because you can't spend too long perfecting it, that's a big thing. When I started to write a novel, I got out of that frame of mind and was all the time thinking, oh, this word has to be perfect and I can't move on till I've perfected this. And once you realise how much you achieve, once you write it down and come back to it a week, a month, 6 months later, how much power there is in standing back and not worrying about what you originally write. The confidence, one, to know I could write, but, you know, I think anyone can write if they put the work in. And secondly, knowing that whatever you write is not going to be perfect. And it is a big polishing process.
I know that you've done quite a few courses in New York. You've done them here.
The course I did in New York was a character course, and we got a list of questions to create a good character profile. And those questions were fabulous. It was all the most obscure things about a character and things from childhood. Well, you know, what was their big pain and those kind of things, which for my characters, it's not so important, because my characters are not, we're not dealing with some massive dysfunction or something. So for me, it was just, you know, what's your favourite colour? Who do you admire most in the world? What kind of books do you read? Once you build a really full, comprehensive and vivid character profile, I think your books write themselves.
Right.
So I think if you can go and, as a piece of advice, build your characters, write about your characters, you know, ad infinitum before you even...
I almost stopped listening, because this is so opposite to the way I write, instead of like glazing over.
Because if you have a bunch of characters, let's say you've got your three characters, you know them inside out, you can give them anything. You don't really have to worry about the plot. You can give them, you know, a lion escapes from the zoo, or you can give them a car crash, and you sort of know how they're going to respond.
Is that how the channeling happens for you, though, when you're building that character?
I'm not sure. Being open, channeling, let it come through, don't judge it.
Yeah, this I can totally relate to that part of it. If suddenly you find that place, And it's your writer's place. It's like obviously your heart speaking in a way.
Your heart is speaking.
Your heart is absolutely speaking through that character.
Yes, and yeah. One of the things about what comes through, I've noticed, is that really obscure things that you might have read or concluded about life a long time ago suddenly creep into a character and you go, wow, it's just showing up here.
Oh, I think any type of artistic expression is so good for your soul.
Well, if you've got a long-held dream and you can sort of see that you're not terrible at it.
Yes.
That's a really good one. I was thinking about that today. I thought, as I was coming to this interview, why do I write? One is I know that happiness is about a creative expression somehow in your life. And, you know, there's lots of other things I do that are creative that are enjoyable, but writing is that very specific, large tapestry of creativity. Yeah, yeah. I would have given up if I hadn't gone to writer's group.
Yeah, feedback that feeds into the process that makes you a better writer.
Yes. The things you think, oh, maybe that's good, and then someone in the group goes, oh, that was really good, and you go, oh, okay, good, I can trust myself. You know, your standards of your own are too high, you're too much of a perfectionist, but going to a writer's group literally kind of unleashed this love of your own writing.
Yes,
and it's really, really powerful.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I always used to complain in writers' group, all the men are writing stories with action. Where's the feeling in those stories? And all the women are just like all these feelings, which clearly, you know, when you write a story with feelings, some of your own feelings are in there.
Any of your characters, have any of them, you know, since you were talking about character building, surprised you that have come through?
Look, I think some of them who were more aggressive than me, because I would not call myself particularly aggressive. I have to really conjure something to create those characters. But look, I am surprised at, look, I'm not, I do not like to write sex.
But I know. I'm just telling you all, I've heard her speak out sex scenes and she scrunches up her face.
I'd like to say my sex scenes are not sexy.
They're pretty sexy.
Oh, no, don't say that, Maria. I don't want them to be sexy. They're meant to be a little crazy, not right. But yes, and that was difficult. I keep thinking my mother as I'm doing it, going, I'm really sorry. But it's not me. It's like this channeled voice is writing the sex scene that...
Where are you up to now in your book?
Well, I had one set of beta readers. I finished it and that feedback was great. But that involved quite a big restructuring of the book. And then I've just recently given it to someone else, and that's a film person, so they're used to reading script. Because my book is set in America, I'm going to take it and find an editor over there.
So your book, just give me kind of a praises of...
So it's set in publishing. It's actually started with the editor of an obituary section of a broadsheet in New York. Okay. They've been taken over by private equity, these kind of Wall Street money men, which is... And this guy who's taken over wants... The obituary section jazzed up, and I have written obituaries myself. So he comes in, wants to change it, wants it kind of more sexy, more drama, and brings in this character from a magazine who lost her job, who did write about celebrities and drama, and a third character, Lillian, who I'm going to read about today, who's a grammar language freak, who's this solid, dependable obituary writer.
Do you still have the ambition that this would become the platform for a television series?
Well, I think it has that potential, because obituaries being something where you've got a continual stream of dead interesting people around them.
And now just share with me that story that you told us in writers group, which is that when you're working for obituaries, you get a list of people who might die.
So advance obituaries have already been written for probably everybody famous you can think of, every president, all the royalty. They're sitting there and they get updated once in a while.
Oh, actually, it's just like another world.
Well, it gives an opportunity in the book to occasionally interview someone before they die and get their story firsthand. So it was another element to the book. It worked for me.
My sister used to tell me, being in the fashion industry, knew virtually every physical defect of every top model. Self-soothing.
Yes, that's funny. That's an element too. There's a lot of joy out of other people's faults. But when you're sitting in the dental surgery and you open up the magazine and someone famous has got a whole bunch of cellulite, like, wow, that's great.
That's great.
That's awesome. The best part of the mag. Yeah. We don't care that they've married someone.
The cellulite pictures, they're
always perfect
fun.
Lives. We don't care. It's the downfall, I think, we're most interested in.
Yeah. Thank God we're writers, you know. What's the name of the book?
Stupefaction, in other words.
Love it. Okay.
So we're up to a place where we get to know that the character Lillian, who works for Obituaries. She's a quiet, antisocial character. We discover that she's writing a novel. It's a scene at her home with her mother. Lillian's mother, Enid, a large woman with generous bosom and hair styled in a helmet of short curls, was splayed on an armchair patterned in an explosion of pink peonies. The chair was set in a deep recline, causing her to lie almost horizontal. The TV quietly played a Hallmark Channel original movie, a repeat of Signed, Sealed, Delivered. The room was in dainty order. Lace curtains with a frill hung from every window. A bunch of dried lavender sat at the centre of the dining table. The dining chairs, bentwood pine, were part of the country cottage suite Enid had purchased over 30 years before. A ginger cat was asleep on Enid's lap. On the bookshelf, another cat, a tabby, was also asleep, its belly exposed in a posture of extreme acquiescence. The sleeping cats imbued the room with an ambience of comfortable torpidity. Only the incessant tapping on a computer of her daughter Lillian, seated at the dining room table, interjected the calm. She was writing a novel. Cantor Billington III studied the face of the woman before him. Her bright smile belied a timidity. Amy Proust was the personal assistant of his late father, Cantor Billington II. For Amy, Cantor Jr. wasn't just a Billington, a family worth $5.4 billion according to the latest Forbes Rich List, and probably more like $6.5 billion based on her own inside knowledge of the family's holdings. But he was handsome, the kind of man Amy would have found attractive if she'd spotted him picking up trash by the side of the road. His rugged face was encased in a jaw that was more edifice than just bone and skin. His shoulders wide and posture tall and straight like you'd expect from a man who, from birth, was part of the one percenters, never cowed by the burdens of a regular life. Cantor Billington III was simultaneously classically handsome and outdoorsy. In Amy's mind, an image flashed of Cantor Jr. chopping wood in a flannel shirt and then jumped to him in a tuxedo, holding a glass of champagne. In this private fantasy, Cantor looked just as comfortable and devastatingly handsome in both scenarios. Lillian was not aware that the physical appearance she had concocted for her imaginary character Cantor was a more virile version of her actual boss, Chester. "What are you up to now?" asked Enid, her mother. "Cantor just met Amy for the first time." "What's she think?" "She thinks he's handsome." "That goes without saying." "In a rugged way." "Good. Those readers don't like pretty boys. How'd you get him rugged?" "His jaw is an edifice." "Edifice, good, I like that. I'm not sure about his name, though. Billington, Billion, too obvious." "Not obvious, genius." Lillian had been writing her first e-book in the subcategory of sexy billionaire romance for the last month. All Lillian's knowledge about romance writing was obtained from the Regina Marks Writing School. The school's 10-week video course, entitled Sexy and Selling, had been a step-by-step guide to self-publishing a sexy romance, no experience necessary. And even though the no experience referred to the writing, for Lillian it meant no experience of the subject matter. Regina Marks, with a hive of tawny dyed hair and moon face, had declared the reader romance novel does not want a dose of smelly-socked, fleecy-backed, nose-haired, toenail-cutting, burping, farting, real man. Nor did the reader of a romance novel want a man that waxes, lasers, plucks, colours, styles, or spends any time at all studying or improving his appearance. No, a romance novel is a place where sinewed biceps and large, strong hands should forcefully enfold the heroine, allowing the reader to fantasize the same, where the action scenes were conducted under flattering candlelight, with a slow enchantment of tortured inner desires and ardent glances, with an occasional set of fluffy handcuffs, are the building blocks of nail-biting suspense. Lillian had immersed herself in the world which she liked to describe as fluttery, fruitful, fantastic love. It was a place where desire was always and eventually vehemently reciprocated. A writing timetable had been drawn up, setting out a weekly count of 3,000 words, which Lillian had so far achieved with ease. The working title Lillian had given her first book, The Billionaire and the Shy Virgin, was partly drawn on her real life, since she was a virgin. Lillian was not perturbed by her lack of experience with men, since Jane Austen, she liked to remind herself, the best romance writer of all time, was a virgin spinster. In fact, she considered a lack of experience an advantage. An outsider may have wondered if Lillian's state of 30-something virginity was a foil for a seething, unrequited passion. But the reality was different. Lillian believed her skill at romance writing was not born of a deep, unfulfilled desire, but the simple fact she personally had never been tainted by any kind of real-life romance. Lillian concluded that other writers in the category may have known more about the mechanics of sex and the intimate emotions of love, but their casual use of a dangling modifier or a split and finisher left Lillian appalled. And there was the vocabulary of those authors, which Lillian thought of as ponderous, commonplace, stale. If other romance authors could make money from writing about billionaires and their hapless prey, she could too, but with perfect syntax and impressive language.
Thank you. And thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Or not studio, as it might be.
Off part of someone's bedroom.
on a dining table with a panel on it.
Okay, thanks, Maria.
And now on to the critique part of our program. So, Arik Sinanian.
Hi, Maria.
We've just listened to Cat Davey, because I could see you grinning all over the place, thoughtful at other times.
I guess I was concentrating because she brought up just about every issue that as a writer am facing and have faced, and I suspect every other writer who's ever attempted to write anything.
Well, first of all, let me like pinpoint you, because you're an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And well, you describe who you are.
Well, although I pursued an engineering, very structured technical career.
As a climate change expert.
Yeah, yeah. And all the while, from a very young age, like always wanted to write. And I have written. There are bits and pieces of paper in the bottom of every drawer.
From way back.
From way back.
Well, you punctuated your technical career with a book.
Yes, and I must say, compared to what I'm embarking on now, and this is what Kat has enlightened me with, is that writing about climate change was a relatively easy, a natural progression of the things that I have done for decades.
Mm. You're very different. You're not from the fashion industry.
No.
you're not in business.
Some people would say I'm as far away from the fashion industry as one could be.
When I sort of spoke to you the other day about uplit
literature,
you went, what?
I didn't know what you were talking about.
So how?
Maybe I should read more of that.
I'm really interested in how Kat's work and Kat's approach and Kat's mission virtually is impacting you.
Well, I felt, in fact, I was making signals to you when we were listening. I actually saw parallels because she started life, I mean, her professional writing very, very structured, but now she's embarking on a completely different course.
On reflection, what was it that you most got out of her interview before she read?
Oh, I've got so many things, Maria. The process that she found really useful in character development and the effect of know your characters and you know your story.
Yes, know your characters, know your story.
Yeah, so that, and allowing herself to do this is admirable.
What about, because I will let you know, listener, Arik, even though he's more than halfway through writing his first novel, has never attended a writer's group.
And that's another issue that Kat has brought up. That was another grimace on my face. I need to do that, because I think we all know writing is a very lonely passion.
Yes.
You're in your own head. You're in your own little creative space. You create this bubble in which you go into. And that's fine, and that's good. It's part of the process. But then to break out of that bubble, that's what Kat talked about. First is trusting in your own thoughts, processes, words, expression, characters, plot, everything.
Mm.
And that trust, I don't think you can do it by yourself. I think it's good to get feedback as honest as possible from others to kind of either verify that trust or...
And that's the slippery slope. And this is where, I think Kat started to talk about that. Okay, she came with 10,000 words.
Mm.
Put it to the test. Let other people hear it.
Mm.
So you have to make a decision as a writer, I think, whether you're writing for yourself or whether you're writing for an audience.
Yep.
It's a very sharp precipice, that one.
Mm, it is.
It's almost like a razor blade. You go, I enjoy this so much, this writing process.
Mm.
If I keep it to myself, I will always enjoy it.
But
if I want somebody else to read it, I have to let it taste oxygen.
Exactly. Well, and I think what she emphasized was we write because we want it heard. Coming back to my thoughts on Kat's interview, I mean, because I want my book to be read, then it has to be tested. And this is why I've been avoiding it. Frankly, if it means I get the feedback that it's absolute garbage, of course, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt deeply because all these notes that I've written were all good. But even then, it means maybe I need to go about it in a different way.
Yeah. I did find that one of the things that happened when people had the courage to actually come to a writer's group is that their egos broke down because there's this space of, you know, what the hell? I've just bared myself. So what else have I got to lose?
No. I've done it now. The cellulite is there. I've got nothing else to hide.
And she used the word, it just flows.
Yes.
Can you relate to that?
Absolutely. And that sweet spot or what? It's a real high. You feel it. It's visceral.
Yeah.
I guess that's why we do it.
That's why we do it. What is it that you like about Kat through her interview and her writing?
Her sense of humour.
Yes.
It came through in the reading she did.
Yeah.
But the other thing that came through was her authenticity. She said in the beginning that she didn't have a voice as such.
Yeah.
The voice ended up finding her.
Yes.
It wasn't mentioned in her interview, but I kept thinking about the word courage. Describing her journey so far, I was fascinated by the obituary stories.
Yes.
It's how wonderful to have all these obituaries sitting there waiting for these people to die.
Is she the kind of person you'd avoid socially?
No, I think I'd like to get to know her more because I really admired, I noticed how observant. She actually reminded me of a Vermeer painting. The way she describes the room, the typing, the mother. I had in my head a very clear image of that scene, of that room, of that particular space.
You know, as she's writing over it, bent
tap,
over
tap, 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 tap.
What about the social commentary? Every sentence is loaded with it.
It's subtly done. It weaves through. You know what it's like? It's a bit like, you know, music in a movie.
Mm.
In this case, you don't want the description and the nuances and the subtext, if you like, to take over.
So she's done that skillfully, hasn't she?
Well, it's very good.
And yet, you know, the yearning of the soul. It's like you. You barely wanted to talk about your very successful career and in engineering. You wanted to talk about writing because your writer soul has been awakened kind of thing.
Stories are so important to us connecting, to us sharing, revealing who we are as humans.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. It's a weave, And stories are woven, aren't they?
Yes.
Sometimes the stitches sort of fall apart.
Fray at the seams.
But we have to get
them apart at times. Absolutely.
Right. That's right.
Well, Eric, I think we've talked this one through.
Do you think?
Yeah. I think I'm we sure could keep on talking
we
forever.
We can keep on going.
But thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Maria. Really wonderful.
Thank you, Eric.
This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program. Produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH, also in the studio of Jeff Furolo in Des Moines. I look forward to your company next time.